Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an Associate Dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I'm serving as the host for this first addendum on the Undisclosed series on Keith Davis Jr. I'm joined by two special guests. The first is Kelly Davis, who is Keith Davis Jr.'s wife and an advocate for him and criminal justice reform. So, Kelly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello.
And I know you were just talking with Keith and sharing the episode. Has he been listening to the episode?
Yes, he's been listening to the episode since he called this evening. So this is his first time calling today, and he's listened to about 10 minutes of it, and he was just in the middle of finishing up.
How often do you talk to him?
Every day, a couple of times a day. Mm-hmm. One of his lawyers has said before, Keith calls home more often than most.
And my other guest today is Amelia McDonald Perry. She is both one of the hosts of the Undisclosed series and Freddie Gray, as well as the host for the Keith Davis Jr. series. So, Amelia, welcome to Undisclosed again.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm excited to be back.
And so this, as we noted in the first episode, is unique for Undisclosed. We usually handle cases where the defendant has already been convicted and we're trying to prove a wrongful conviction. Whereas this is a case where it's been prosecuted several times, and the state has this theory they keep pushing, where they say that Keith robbed this cab driver, this hack, this illegal cab driver, ran away, was shot at by police, ran into this garage, had the phone call with you, Kelly, saying, I'm going to die. And their claim is they chased him into this garage, shot at him, found him with gunshot wounds, and found him holding this handgun, and claim that he is a felon in possession of a firearm and is also guilty of this murder connected to the gun. And so, Amelia, I'll start with you. You know, this is part of the goal of the podcast is to dig beneath that narrative of the state and see whether, in fact, it holds water. What was the first exposure you had to Keith's case?
It was when I went down to Baltimore and I was starting research on the Freddie Gray series. And very, very early on in doing my research for that, a reporter was the first person to mention Keith's name to me. He said, you know, have you heard of Keith Davis Jr.? And I was like, well, no, who's that? And he said, that's a man who's being prosecuted for, he was the first person who was shot by Baltimore police after the death of Freddie Gray. But the difference is that first of all, Keith lived. And second of all, instead of trying the officers for shooting at him, the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, is in fact prosecuting him. And I think at that point when I found out about it, I think Keith had already gone through his first trial, possibly, he'd definitely been charged for the murder by that point. And so it had reached this kind of level of craziness where people were sort of like, wait, what? There's another case that you're charging him with? And so that he was mentioned to me as somebody, you know, that people were sort of saying about him that he was Freddie Gray if Freddie Gray had lived, essentially sort of suggesting that if Freddie Gray had survived his encounter with police and their use of force, that instead of seeking justice for him, they would have been prosecuting him for some sort of crime. They would have found something to sort of pin on him, just as they have with Keith.
Right. And Kelly, what's your reaction when you find out that not only are the police in the case not going to be prosecuted, but instead that Keith is going to be prosecuted for these crimes?
It was kind of odd at that moment, simply because we didn't find out about it at the same time. We found out about these things like in pieces. Like we would go to court after postponement, and then it would come out that, oh, these officers, we can't go to court because no one's talked to them. And then it would come out that, oh, this one, no one's giving a statement. So when Keith was actually in trial is when we found out that no one had ever, right before his trial started, no one talked to officers. I mean, we knew that he was being charged, but we, you know, our thing was, I kept feeling like, well, you know, once they talk to the officers, they'll know that it doesn't make sense and it'll be all cleared up. And that day just never came because, you know, they didn't talk to these officers. They just kind of went after Keith. So it was confusing, but it was also infuriating because, you know, Marilyn Mosby was someone that we thought, you know, as soon as she got hold of this, she would do what she had done with Freddie Gray. So it was a pretty frustrating process.
Yeah, and to that point, Amelia, as you note in the episode, it's impossible to take this case in a vacuum. It's really part of this continuum that starts back in 2014. We had Marilyn Mosby being elected as state's attorney for Baltimore City. When she is elected, she's the youngest top prosecutor in a major U.S. city. January 8th, 2015, she's sworn into office. 3 months after that, we have the arrest of Freddie Gray on April 12th, 2015. And as I noted, you were one of the hosts and investigators for the Freddie Gray series. And for listeners who might be new to Undisclosed, can you kind of give us a thumbnail of what happens when Freddie Gray was arrested?
Sure. So his case caught a lot of attention in part because it was captured on a citizen's cell phone video. So Freddie Gray was chased by three Baltimore police bike officers. They were doing bike duty that day. He was chased for kind of still unclear reasons. One of the officers said that Freddie locked eyes with him and then took off running, which in Baltimore, according to the police, is reason to chase. When they caught him, they arrested him, apparently for what they called a switchblade, an illegal knife. Our sort of assessment is that it was not an illegal knife. But point being, he was put in at the scene when he was being arrested. He was screaming in obvious pain. And so the video caught a lot of attention because it was so upsetting to watch. That went viral. And what happened from there was a sort of source of some mystery. He was put inside a police transport van, theoretically to be taken either down to the district, the Western District in Baltimore, or to the central booking. What ended up happening was that van, according to the police, made four additional stops before going back to the district. By the time that the van got back to the district, about 45 minutes after Freddie was initially arrested, he was found unconscious, not breathing. And then when they took him to the hospital, it was discovered that his spine had been broken severely to the point where it put such severe spinal cord pressure on his cervical spine that he lost the ability to breathe. And he essentially died a week later of an anoxic brain injury. The kind of mystery, so to speak, around that was like, what happened to Freddie? When did his neck get broken? You know? And I think early on, a lot of people, if you saw the video, the association was like, oh, it must have happened then. The way that one of the officers had put his knee in Freddie's kind of upper back neck area. But, you know, there was also this sort of long van ride with multiple stops. That's what we sort of were told. And in sort of investigating that, what we found was that the van definitely did make additional stops. We were sort of not convinced of one or two of them, or at least the evidence to support one or two of those stops was not very good. But in any case, the narrative sort of served to suggest that whatever happened inside the van and wasn't by human hands. And what ended up happening is that Marilyn Mosby charged six officers after about a 2 week long investigation by the police department and supposedly an independent investigation by her office. And the case they ended up taking to court against those six officers, they tried four of them, was based on this idea that Freddie, I don't think they ever really so much used this argument. They didn't use this phrase in court so much, but the argument and the sort of myth that goes along with what happened to Freddie is that he endured a rough ride where essentially a van driver was, you know, driving, jerking around, and that he at some point, because he was unseatbelted, he fell and broke his neck. What we found was I spent a lot of time interviewing witnesses, civilian witnesses who early on had been talking to the press, but then after the police sort of pushed this narrative in another direction, were ignored. They very clearly remember, there was a couple witnesses we found who remember seeing Freddie thrown headfirst when he was both handcuffed and shackled at the feet into a two-partition van, and that his head hit the wall. And that's our theory, was sort of like that's a more likely cause than the van driver taking a not all that hard right turn. So, yeah.
At last count, I probably had about 8 bottles of shampoo and 10 bottles of conditioner in my shower stall because I'm pretty much never satisfied with hair products. I'm always looking for like that one, the one that like covers all of my needs. And yes, I do have hair under the scarf and it's lovely. However, as I get older, you know what? I want more volume, I want more shine, I want my hair to be healthy, and I finally found the right product, thanks to Function of Beauty. So Function of Beauty, the way it works, it's totally personalized for your head of hair. It addresses all your hair concerns, not just one. Like, you know, you go to the department store, or you go to the drugstore, it'll be like, oh, this shampoo's to preserve your color, or this one's to volumize. Well, you can actually decide, like, this is what I want my hair product to do. You can choose up to 5 hair goals to add to your formula. And Function of Beauty individually formulates every single bottle just for you, based on your hair type, your hair goals, and your preferences. One of the things I love the most is you can pick the color and fragrance of your hair product. Now, I know some people don't like dyes and don't like fragrances, and you can also get the hair products without it. But you know what? For me, I say load it up. I love my hair to smell good. But here's the thing. They have safe, natural ingredients because Function of Beauty never uses sulfates, parabens, mineral oils, or any other harmful ingredients. They're also vegan and cruelty-free. And look, here's the thing. You might not know this, but the sad reality is that most major drugstore brands actually test on animals. But Function of Beauty is 100% vegan and cruelty-free. You get salon-level quality at a better price, over 40% less per ounce than the leading salon brands. It's not going to break your bank. Also, the bottles come with... Thank you, Susan, for reminding me. The bottles came with stickers. My daughter stole the stickers, but it's okay. They're stickers so you can decorate your cute little bottle. It's kind of adorable. Look, our listeners will get 20% off their custom formula. So to claim it, go to functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed right now and take a quick 2-minute hair profile quiz to design your 100% unique shampoo and conditioner formulas. Go to functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed right now and get 20% off your first order at functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed.
Yeah, and so this is then early May. We have the medical examiner determining this is a homicide. We have Marilyn Mosby bringing the charge against the Baltimore police officers. And the shooting of Keith Davis Jr. is on June 7th. And so, Kelly, as you noted before, based upon Marilyn Mosby's handling of the Freddie Gray case and the whole Baltimore uprising and everything going on in Baltimore, what are your thoughts on Marilyn Mosby sort of heading into June and how she's handling this Freddie Gray case as this Keith Davis Jr. case is coming across her desk?
I just, at the hospital, you know, like soon as we realized that, you know, things are just not adding up, I just kept saying, you know, I need to do something. And I remember calling my mom and crying, and she's like, Kelly, you know what? You got to calm down. This is not getting you anywhere. You got to get some answers. And I called my pastor at the time, and that was Pastor Jamal Bryant. And I knew that he had a direct connection to her. And I was so sure that as soon as she saw it, as soon as it hit her desk, because I kind of had felt like she was just kind of like this underdog who just couldn't be conformed, and she was going to do things her way, and she was going to do them the right way. Mm-hmm. I knew, you know, as soon as we were clear that something was really wrong, we knew that she would be the one to clear it up. So I was anticipating it getting to her desk. And I actually kind of told everyone at the hospital and those days afterwards that, you know, we just got to get, you know, it just has to get to her, and then it'll all kind of be cleared up. Keith as well, you know, one of the mm-hmm. things that he kind of wrote on a napkin was, you know, like, I'm sure she'll figure this out. You know, he never anticipated going to jail from the hospital. He figured it would get to someone like Marilyn Mosby, and she would definitely fix this.
And have you ever had a chance throughout this process to speak with her personally, to sort of have a sit down?
Not a sit down, not a one-on-one. not at all. I have had to kind of take an opportunity to talk to her after countless emails. And I mean, I had an opportunity to actually go into the state's attorney's office, but I was not able to speak with her. But countless times of emailing and trying to communicate, I kind of just had to take an opportunity to talk to her one-on-one.
And was there a specific point for you when you realized that she wasn't going to be on your side, or was it more sort of a gradual process where you realized incrementally that this wasn't going to go the way you expected?
When Keith was charged, I knew little about the criminal justice system. So I didn't know that, like, the police charge you and then it's the state that indicts you. And, you know, so I had to kind of get like a crash course in those first a couple of hours after he was arrested. And I kind of learned that, okay, wait a minute, maybe she's not coming to my rescue. So that's when I started to kind of reach out. And slowly but surely, as he kind of had his arraignment, as he kind of had his indictment, and actually, ironically, that was the first time that I actually met, which would be his defense counsel for most of his trials, LaToya Francis Williams, at a DOJ event, because at that time, the Department of Justice was on the ground. And she was like, hey, you can't keep wasting time. You know, your help is not coming. You have to do it yourself. So I'd say toward the end of June, the beginning of July, it was clear to me that maybe either she's not in, she's on vacation, or she's just not coming.
Right. And so then, Emilio, we sort of again have these cases running in parallel, the cases against the police officers in the Freddie Gray case and the case against Keith Davis Jr. And so again, for those who might not be following the Freddie Gray case, what's happened in these prosecutions of the police officers?
So after they were charged on May 1st, 2015, there was a kind of continuing investigation working in concert with the police department to kind of continue to build this case that they were going to try these officers on. They were all given individual trials, so they weren't tried all as a group. And the first person to go to trial was William Porter in December of 2015. He was the only officer to take a jury trial, actually. And that was a hung jury, the verdict there. And he was going to be retried again a little bit later after a couple of the other officers. So then the next person to go to trial was Edward Nero. And he made the kind of unusual decision to take a bench trial, which was interesting, especially because there was going to be one judge to preside over all of the trials. So once Officer Nero took a bench trial and that case went in his favor, he was acquitted. All the other officers very quickly decided that they were going to take a bench trial as well. And that, I think, was, I mean, it makes sense strategically for them. I can't fault them for it. But it also, I think, had the effect of limiting transparency, actually, around the sort of evidence in this case, because the judge had seen, you know, he'd see a lot of things in one trial, and then it allowed them to sort of skip past the sort of public acknowledgement of certain bits of evidence in the other cases. So what ended up happening is, so Edward Nero was acquitted. After that, it was Caesar Goodson, who was the van driver. He was actually the one who was charged with the highest charge, second degree murder, depraved heart murder. And he was acquitted as well. And then after that was the lieutenant, Brian Rice. He was acquitted as well. And then a few weeks after that, in August of 2016, Marilyn Mosby dropped the charges against the two remaining officers who had not stood trial, Garrett Miller and Alicia White, and as well as William Porter, who was going to be retried. But they dropped those, all the rest of the charges, and she essentially tossed in the towel. And the blame was kind of, what's interesting is that her office, the two prosecutors who were on the case, Janice Bledsoe and Michael Chatel, afterwards kind of implied that the reason why the case, they were having such a hard time with the case, is because the police department investigators had sort of screwed up the investigation. And I would agree, but I would say that that happened much earlier on. And in fact, their case was built entirely on the work of what's called the FIT team, the Force Investigation Team, which just so happens to be the same investigators that were tasked with investigating the police-involved shooting of Keith Davis Jr.
Right. And then, Kelly, we have the flip side of this, which is, I've done a lot of research into the American criminal justice system, and I think there are three cases that stand out from the rest. One is the case of Curtis Flowers, prosecuted mm-hmm. six times for a murder in Mississippi. His case was just heard by the Supreme Court. Kyles versus Whitley is another Supreme Court case, a murder in New Orleans. Harry Connick Sr., the father of Harry Connick Jr., prosecuted that case five times. The only other case I've ever heard of with five separate prosecutions, and that'll be the case this summer, is the case of your husband, Keith. Those are the numbers. They can only tell us so much. What emotionally, mentally, physically has been the toll on Keith, you, and your families for these prosecutions extending out over these years?
This has been a nightmare, and it's a never-ending nightmare. I think for Keith, and I kind of actually just kind of expressed this to his defense attorney this week, Keith kind of went through the motion of, I need my defense attorneys to come and talk to me to let me know what's going on. And he's now adopted this mantra of, I just want to get into court. I think that we have had so many experiences where we've had to learn the law and we know the law and we go over it together. And we have, you know, defense attorneys telling us, hey, the law says this. And we get into that courtroom and the judges, their orders or their calls tie the hands of the defense and we are just devastated. And so I think that we kind of have learned to not expect much, but for the most part, it's grueling and it's excruciating. I work, I have four children. They've had to kind of continue their relationship with him from prison. We used to could visit him twice a week and then he moves facilities. And, you know, I'm juggling all of these things, his health, his freedom, his liberty, a household, children, and it's never ending. And it just feels so goddamn unfair. And, you know, you get to see other people, you know, that you've, you know, stories and cases in the city and above, and they have some resolution and we just don't. But I know that, I mean, I can't just kind of resolve and take what we've been given, which is mistrial after mistrial, conviction, overturn. We just got to keep going until he's home. And that's the only way to make this right.
Yeah, and we got a comment on Facebook following up on your point. This person said, his wife has been advocating her ass off in Baltimore. I'm glad it's finally getting some recognition. And so, Kelly, as you said, you're kind of, so to speak, learning on the job. What were your impressions of the criminal justice system before Keith was shot? And did you ever think that you would be an advocate out there for criminal justice reform?
No. And I kind of briefly talked about that today on Twitter, as so many of my friends from high school have kind of reached out. I grew up in the city, but my parents brought a house in the county in Catonsville, and I moved there when I was 14. So, you know, my shaping around that in the criminal justice system was pretty much minimal. You know, I lived in Catonsville, which is a small town. The police are normally our friends' family, if not our friends that we've grown up to school. I was nowhere near an advocate. I was nowhere near, even with Freddie Gray, like, you know, that was like a water cooler question at work. And I never took a stance and I never had an opinion. My opinion was just simply like, oh, well, I don't know, because I had no reason to question law enforcement. I had no reason to have a grasp of the criminal justice system. I barely have a parking ticket. So, you know, it was just something that wasn't on my radar. And I know that sounds kind of bad now, like I'm a wannabe activist, which I don't think I'm an activist at all. But I mean, I just had no reason to explore it. I had no reason to be skeptical. I mean, just none at all. It was something that actually didn't affect me. So I didn't take notice to it.
Yeah, and Amelia, as long as I've known you, you've been, of course, very passionate about criminal justice issues, wrongful convictions, reform. But I'm not actually sure that I know your history. Is there sort of one event that sparked your interest, or sort of years of building up and seeing these issues? Or what was it that led you to sort of be this reporter digging into these cases?
I mean, I think I grew up in a household where my parents very much taught me to question authority. My father had spent 3 years in prison before I was born, and my dad had a real, he had a strong feelings about law enforcement, prison, all of that. And I also, you know, and I can say back on my life and looking back on my relationship with my dad, I can see very much how prison affected him in the long term for his sort of mental health, physical health, et cetera. So I think that that was something that was inside me kind of growing a seed, but I very much had to kind of learn for myself through just reading about people's stories and learning to sort of question the narratives were sort of fed about police and prosecutors. But the thing that I would say, you know, and I was always interested in, and, you know, I love a crime documentary, that kind of thing. But the thing that I honestly will say that really changed my life as far as this work is concerned was hearing Adnan's story on Serial. I just got so obsessed with it. And I was obsessed with it because it was obviously a compelling narrative, but I was obsessed with the fact that it just seemed so like obviously wrong what had happened, and I couldn't understand why it couldn't just be fixed. And, you know, I started following that case, and I was like, I need to do a different job. I need to be doing something different with my life. Is I went and covered Adnan's PCR hearing for a website I had run. And I found it so fun and interesting, and I was so fired up about it. And I loved Undisclosed. And that was honestly really what changed my life. Like, I think I always say it was like Rabia, hearing Rabia and seeing what she does and just wanting to like be obsessed with a particular case and get to the bottom of it in hopes of righting a wrong. And to me, the Keith Davis Jr. case to me is so obviously screwed up. You know, you mentioned the fact that Keith is one of these three cases that you can think of as it's really sort of unique by the amount of times that he's been prosecuted. And you know, it's interesting because Marilyn Mosby has really built her national reputation on being the prosecutor who charged the officers in the Freddie Gray case, but she lost those cases. And as far as I'm concerned, if she's going to, you know, have that be her defining case, she needs to have as well her prosecution and persecution of Keith Davis Jr. be right up beside it. Because to me, it's a far more career defining choice that she's made, that she refuses to kind of own responsibly. And part of why I wanted to do this podcast is I wanted to draw attention to that. I feel like, you know, we did it with the Freddie case. Well, this is part two, as far as I'm concerned.
What do you find difficult about managing a business? If you're a small business owner, HoneyBook.com can help you spend less time handling the administrative work and more time doing what you love. HoneyBook is an all-in-one business management platform for creative small businesses. HoneyBook makes it easy to streamline your process with client and calendar management tools and custom branded proposals and contracts. You can even get e-signatures, generate invoices, and get paid faster, all within one online system. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, and other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of hours a year with HoneyBook. And that's why we've partnered with HoneyBook.com to offer Undisclosed listeners 50% off the first year of HoneyBook with promo code Undisclosed. So get started at HoneyBook.com today and use promo code Undisclosed for 50% off your first year. Again, that's HoneyBook.com, promo code Undisclosed.
Yeah, and so, Amelia, you mentioned the Adnan Syed case and the dogged pursuit of justice by Rabia partially piquing your interest. This case, the Keith Davis Jr. case, has primarily been investigated and presented by women. We have the two of you. We have Ella Sperry writing a piece for The Intercept. We have in the Ronnie Long case that we covered on the podcast, his wife Ashley fighting for justice over the years. And I'm not the first person to say this. There's been a lot written about how criminal justice reform is a feminist issue and that women are taking the lead in criminal justice reform. And so for both of you, why do you think that criminal justice reform is a feminist issue? And why do you think it is women who are really leading the charge on many of these issues?
I mean, what I can say is that I think that, I don't have personal experience with this myself, but I think when you look at the actual sort of statistics about who is incarcerated, it is not should not come as a surprise that when a large volume of Black men are sent to prison, that they are leaving wives and girlfriends and children at home. And those wives and children and women and their partners are left to carry the burden. So it's a feminist issue in that sense. It affects, you know, their lives in huge ways. You know, I think that people think of criminal justice and sort of like crime and policing and all this stuff is sort of like a man's world. And so I definitely have felt personally as a woman trying to do this work a little bit not taken seriously, let's put it that way. So for me, that's my sort of personal experience with it. But just sort of observing, I have seen somebody like Kelly to me is, I don't know how Kelly does what she does every day. I can barely do, I haven't done laundry in like 3 weeks. So, and I don't have a child, let alone four, let alone the sort of stuff that she's carrying. So I have so much admiration for her. And she's been a tremendous advocate for Keith and just a phenomenal person. Everybody who I talk to about this case, they want to talk about Kelly like as a subject in herself because she has been the leader of this fight. Everybody who's sort of backed Keith and who's on Team Keith and who supports Keith is also there for Kelly because she's a phenomenal person. She's a born organizer. This may not be what she thought she was ever going to be doing, but my God, she's good at it. So I'm just so sorry that it had to happen because of something so tragic and unnecessary.
Yeah, and Kelly, following up on that with Amelia calling you a natural organizer, you have your group, Baltimore Block. And what can you tell us about Baltimore Block?
Baltimore Block is a grassroots organization that was around a while, even before Freddie. They kind of always fed the homeless. They kind of always had like books for the kids. And they just kind of were a group of everyday people. And I think that, you know, for Amelia to say that all of the things that I have responsible, Baltimore Black, they're everyday people with husbands and girlfriends and children. And, you know, they kind of just throw themselves in wherever they're needed. So when Freddie, with Tyrone West and Tawanda Jones, they kind of advocated for her with Greg Bernstein. They are very instrumental in Marilyn Mosby actually being elected. They kind of got behind her in the election against Bernstein and kind of, you know, was with her and they supported Tawanda Jones. And then when Freddie Gray came in the uprising, they were, you know, right there on the front line, you know, everywhere helping out the community. And when this thing happened with Keith, for a long time, I was by myself, just kind of maneuvering, trying to, you know, work through these things. And one of the Block members, one of the actually founders of Block, he reached out to me and then it used to just kind of be him and I. And then he kind of brought me into around the other members and I've kind of connected and had my own personal experience with all of them. So they are the real deal. One of the things that you'll see in Baltimore, and Amelia can probably tell you, I'm the least clickiest person ever. I kind of have my side eye for everybody. There are a lot of organizations that kind of was here and kind of lingered before the uprising. And then there are others that kind of start, you know, they kind of built up from the ashes of the uprising. And they all have different motives and intentions and struggles and things that they want to be privy to. But Block, to me, is the real deal. They have no agenda. They have no perfect victim or someone to support. They are here for everyone and anything. And I think that is something that I've learned in this situation is important, is that, you know, you can't kind of pick and choose, you know, what to support and what to uplift and elevate. You know, they will kind of go and support everyone. And I think that they absolutely don't get the recognition that they deserve because they're not in the spotlight, because they're not, you know, asking for monetary grants or that, you know, they're just not on the scene. A lot of their work does not get recognized. And I think that is a true testament to that they're the real deal in this grassroots organization game.
Yeah, they're not into politics at all. So, you know, they don't have these things that they take a stance on issue-wise, but then behind the scenes, they're, you know, making sort of excuses, you know, for certain people because that person in power is giving them some support on this one issue. And so they're going to overlook what they're doing on another issue. Like Block to me is they have their principles at the forefront, and they are also, they don't use victims. They only ever work in tandem with the family members of victims of police brutality if the family members want them, and then they sort of follow their lead. So, you know, you don't hear about Block because Block is not out there promoting themselves. But I think they are some of the most organized, true, like principled people I've ever met. And their support for Kelly over the last few years has been tremendous. And I can say that actually when I first started doing research into the Keith case, I obviously read all the press coverage of it. And the most valuable information I got about Keith's case, particularly when all the trials, was through Kelly, of course, and then also through various Block members and other members of Team Keith who would, you know, during court breaks and stuff, would live tweet certain things that were happening in the courtroom. And they were catching things that I think because of their familiarity with the case, they were catching things that reporters were not catching. And so when I was sort of starting my initial research, I sort of went back all the way to the beginning of time to, like, you know, June 7th on 2015 on Twitter. And I went through every single tweet and I really sort of started from there. And what I will say is that, like, having now listened to all the trials, having looked at a lot of the evidence, everything that they had been tweeting is spot on. And, you know, so in addition to being really sort of dedicated, they are smart and thorough, and they were catching things that reporters weren't catching. And so to me, and they're just doing it for love and out of genuine belief in this case, in Keith's innocence.
You have the suspect's fingerprints at the crime scene. You have witnesses testifying they saw the suspect commit the crime. The suspect has a motive. It's an open and shut case. Or is it? Each week, the Parcast original Not Guilty examines controversial criminal cases and tries to determine why solid evidence doesn't always lead to a conviction. What police consider compelling evidence against Casey Anthony in the disappearance of her daughter Kaylee, defense attorneys classified as fantasy forensics, and she was ultimately acquitted of Kaylee's murder. Amanda Knox served 4 years in an Italian prison for murder before later being acquitted. Was the media portrayal of Knox the profile of a killer or a televised character assassination? And sometimes, jurors are responsible for wrongful convictions, as was the case when the Central Park Five were convicted despite DNA evidence showing none of the suspects were involved. Search for and subscribe to Not Guilty wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, search Not Guilty or visit parcast.com/notguilty to listen now.
Right, and one interesting component of this, of course, as you note with all this reporting, is we're going to have this fifth trial, presumably this summer. And from what either of you have seen for these sort of second, third, fourth trials, how has jury selection gone? And do you have concerns about sort of a tainted jury pool, maybe not having the complete picture? And as part of the goal with this group and the podcast and everything, to sort of flesh out this picture and give some of the real facts in this case?
I definitely, the jury education, jury selection in the city is something that really grinds my gears. I don't believe the jurors that keep, mind you, Keith has been before 60 jurors. So I don't believe they are a jury of his peers. I just don't. They are usually people that would not be able to relate to his life, past or present. And I think that that's something that is really, really problemsome in this city. I think also the education of jurors and the way that they're instructed. And you know, all of these things are things that systematically is very poor in Baltimore, and no one's doing anything about it. And you know, when I see people be transparent and say, hey, I just got off a jury, their stories are always the same. It's always the lack of education, the lack of perspective. Susan from Roland Park could never understand why a Black man in Park Heights would ever run from the police. They would never understand that, you know, these guys are harassed and beat on and just kind of basically tormented from the time that they're old enough to be outside alone without an adult. And I think that that is an issue. And I think that that's, unfortunately, one of the advantages that the state absolutely exploits.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I wanted to turn to some social media questions. Our first question is an interesting one and gets asked a lot in regard to this case, as well as the Curtis Flowers case. This is by Birdie. Her Twitter handle is @LisaMK67. Thanks for a great podcast. I'm hooked. How can you be charged for the same crime over and over again? Isn't there double jeopardy in the USA? Thanks, Lisa. And so we have this question, and
yeah,
you might come in thinking, you know, how in the world is he prosecuted not just twice, but 3, 4, and now 5 times? And, you know, just Kelly, from the perspective of not being involved in the criminal justice system before, how surprising was it to you when he gets prosecuted over and over again?
It's very surprising. Everyone would kind of tell you that, like, I don't sleep at night. I kind of just sit and research. But Amelia can tell you, I can kind of shout out case law and stuff like I have a law degree. It's surprising when you really, because, you know, when we, the only experience with double jeopardy I have is the movie with Ashley Judd. So immediately I meant like, oh, okay, well, this is up. Well, you had a crack at the apple. It didn't work. And this is over. How can they do this? And then when you really kind of go and look into what the statute actually says, and that's like, hey, until the case is resolved with an acquittal or a guilty finding, you know, something called, what was it? Manifest
necessity.
Yes. Double jeopardy doesn't attach itself. So you can't really, so you think about double jeopardy, and the statute basically says that you can't be kind of put forth before and kind of mess yourself up with giving your case and maybe subjecting yourself to, you know, further penalties. But if there's no resolve, and this is in Keith's case, it was the same weapon that they're alleging, but it's a different circumstances. So same day, same weapon, but a different set of circumstances. So essentially a different charging document, and double jeopardy just doesn't attach itself. And to me, that is just like, they need to put that in the fine print, or they needed to show that in the movie somehow. So
yeah, that's the thing in this case, is that what we haven't quite gotten into yet, and I wanted the first episode to kind of leave people with the sort of WTF feeling, because the sort of explanation behind that is still plenty WTF, but it does make a little more sense. So there are two cases that Keith has been charged for. There was the initial case that was immediately sort of tied directly somewhat to the police-involved shooting in the garage. But then there is another case that has been tried over and over and over again. So there was the first case that is related to the police-involved shooting. But then after that was all settled, all of a sudden, this other case came out of the woodwork. So, and that's the one that has been tried multiple times. And that's because every time it's gone to trial, it has not ended in the resolution that Kelly mentions. And so a lot of prosecutors would, upon getting a hung jury, as was the case at the first murder trial that we haven't quite talked about yet, but, you know, at a certain point, prosecutors sort of have to reassess. They look at the case and they decide, okay, do we have enough here? We were able to convince a jury. Do we want to try this again? And as Mosby did with the officers in the Gray case, you know, after losing four of those trials, she took a look and decided that they couldn't do it again, that they didn't, the chances of them winning were not going to happen. And so she dropped the case. And that's actually what is so kind of infuriating about the case against Keith Davis Jr. is that she has persisted in prosecuting him over and over again, and has apparently not done that same sort of assessment of the case, because they keep bringing it to trial.
So the next question is from Lisa Angela. Her Twitter handle is @Picola1922. And she writes, I found this very confusing. Shots were fired, so Davis understandably ran. Was he being targeted as the person who committed the initial shooting? Wouldn't there be others in the market to establish he was there buying cigarettes? Does any of that matter?
So the shooting that happened was in the garage, but there is a sort of incident that precedes that immediately before it that Keith is charged for. So that's where this sort of episode where Rabia sort of hints at the next episode is going, is how he's been charged with 17 charges related to this incident, including armed robbery, etc. So yes, if he had nothing to do with that, you would think, oh, this is a public area. Surely there's all these cameras, all this potential evidence, witnesses we can interview to make sure he's the right guy. As we will sort of dive into in this next episode, the investigation that happened, first of all, was a real conflict of interest, because there are two things that should have been investigated sort of separately. There's the police-involved shooting. So this sort of shooting by the officers, their use of force, and that's an internal sort of administrative policy assessment, sort of looking at whether or not the officers used necessary force. And then from there, the state's attorney's office could have considered charges against the officers. But then separately, if the officers believe that Keith was guilty of this other crime, then they are free to investigate that if they want to, but that should have been done by entirely separate unit and entirely separate detectives, because, I mean, that's an obvious kind of conflict of interest. And that is, you'll find out, did not at all happen. And so, you know, coincidentally enough, the sort of things that you would think a police department would do to establish that somebody has committed a specific crime were not really done. I mean, and of course, we're also talking about the Baltimore Police Department, where even if they're not trying to cover their own ass, they're not doing top-notch police work. And I feel very confident saying that, and I'm not sorry.
All right. Well, Amelia, that sounds like that's a good transition into what the audience is going to have in episode two. And so I guess the final question I'll ask is to you, Kelly, and that is there any possibility in this case that if Baltimore offered a very favorable plea deal to Keith, that he would consider it? Or is this something where no way, no how, he's going to fight to prove his innocence and he would never accept any type of plea deal in this case?
Well, it's something that has, I mean, quite naturally comes up. And to be honest with you, I'll be completely honest. Keith has been beaten down a lot from this, especially because he was shot. So he's suffering physically as well as with doing all of this. And there has been multiple times that he's like, hey, if they give me a deal, I'll just take it. I just want to come home. And for me, because I have now learned this criminal justice system, and I have now learned kind of how it chews up, especially African-American males, and kind of spits them out, and they do it with these plea deals. For me, there's a no. Essentially, a plea deal for Keith would be, and I think that people also kind of forget that, you know, your plea deal isn't always, I mean, there's an Alford plea, but a lot of times in Baltimore and in Marilyn Mosby's case, my research tells me, is that she does not take Alford pleas. She wants you to plead to exactly what it is that she's accusing you of. And for me, how I get Keith around it is to kind of be like, hey, you know, before I used to be aggressive and be like, what deal? Because if you take a deal, you don't have a home to come home to. So, you know, what are you going to do? And now, you know, I've kind of had said, like, you know, why would you do that? You've suffered, you've gone through this, and then you're going to essentially kind of give yourself a scarlet letter. You know, you're going to not be able to get a job because this is going to be on your record, and that's going to cripple us financially. Even if you wanted to start your own business, people today Google people. That's going to show up. That's going to be there. So, you know, you kind of got to fight through this. And he will kind of come back and say, you know, maybe I need to just be a little bit more patient. So as of right now, the only thing that we're interested in is Keith being completely vindicated. And I don't see how a deal could do that. And as of right now, he's on the same page as me, which he normally is. So no, absolutely not.
All right, well, Kelly and Amelia, thank you so much for joining me today for the Undisclosed Addendum. And I look very much forward to seeing where you're taking this race in the next few episodes. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mithal Talhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.